KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Coming up on Weekday This Hour, Green Day's gardening panel joins us. Once again, they're going to take your calls and questions about gardening. A nice spring gardening question will be welcome. Also, Mark Bittman talking about VB6, vegan before 6, and how a diet feeding vegan through much of your day and then throwing caution to the wind maybe at night is a way to lose weight and stay healthy. But we start with a look at the placenta and autism. Researchers at Yale University and the University of California, Davis, have been studying the placenta of babies born into families that have a high genetic risk for having autism. They found that babies born with that genetic risk for the disorder were more likely to have abnormal folds and creases in their placentas. Dr. Javi Kleiman is research scientist at the Yale School of Medicine and lead author of the study. Dr. Kleiman, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure, Steve.
So, first of all, just on the question of the placenta, placenta is kind of not given a lot of attention. What brought you to want to look at it?
Yeah, it just doesn't get the respect it deserves. I agree with you completely. You know, people don't even realize, most people, that the placenta is part of the fetus of the baby. You know, the baby's born, and then there's the afterbirth. And if you just ask, you know, out there, where's the placenta come from? A lot of people say, well, it's mom's, isn't it? And no, it's actually part of the fetus. So when we look at a placenta, we are actually looking at the fetus, the tissue of the fetus. And probably the best way for people to think about the placenta is a tree. So you see the trunk of the tree, that's like the umbilical cord. Then you have the branches and the leaves, that's the baby, that's the fetus. But under the ground are the roots. Now, we don't see them, but the roots are as important as any other part. And without the roots, you know, if you just cut off the tree at the ground, the tree would die. And that's the same thing that would happen to a fetus if we separated the fetus from its placenta. So it's a very useful tool to understand what the life of that fetus has been inside of the uterus.
I think that's a very interesting way of looking at it, and not one that we often hear. Why is that? Just to stick with that for a moment, why is it that the placenta has not been front and center to a lot of research, a lot of thinking about humanness?
Well, let's think about it. You know, you get pregnant, the parents are really excited, the delivery happens, you got this beautiful baby, or you got the video camera going and the pictures and everything. I think the last thing that people want to do is look at this placenta, which is, you know, very bloody, and it looks like a kind of a cake. It's sort of strange looking. In fact, the name placenta comes from the Latin word cake, and in Europe, the name is actually mother's cake. Again, there's that sort of mistake about who it belongs to. And it's an afterthought. So there really hasn't been a lot of research done on the placenta, and there are only very few people who study it. When I started my pathology residency at the University of Pennsylvania, in fact, doing, you know, work on placentas was viewed as sort of the lowest of the low that you could do. They let the first, you know, month residents when we first came in cut up placentas because they figured we couldn't really hurt them that much. And I think the reason is that after the delivery, everybody says, well, what's the point of looking at the placenta? I mean, the kid's out, so it's done. But just by chance, and most of my discoveries, in fact, all of them, to be honest with you, have been based on chance and serendipity. I just happened to, by chance, work in a lab at University of Pennsylvania that worked on the placenta, became interested in it, and everybody said, oh, God, someone's actually interested in the placenta. Let's give them all the placentas. So every placenta at University of Pennsylvania was sent to me. And the more I did basic research on it, the more interesting it was to me clinically. And what I've learned, and the people who do look at the placenta know, is that it's a tremendous window on the life of the fetus inside, what's happened to it, the injuries it might have suffered. It can explain very well most of the problems. And now clinically at Yale, I actually use it to figure out why women have pregnancy losses, why there are complications with pregnancies. And that was the basis for the work that led to autism, which, again, was a complete accident and serendipity.
How did that? Well, let me ask you about it. So you were quoted in a paper saying that these placental folds or trophoblast inclusions, a check engine light, a marker of something something's wrong, but you don't yet know what it is. What did you, how did you come to it, and what did you see?
That's a great question, Steve. So just to go back a little bit, I've been at Yale for about 22 years, and part of my responsibilities both at University of Pennsylvania and here at Yale when I first came was to deal with women who had pregnancy losses. Now, people had known about trophoblast inclusions for a long time, but they thought that they only were a marker for something called triploidy, and I know that's a complex word, but it's where you have one egg and two sperm. That's very abnormal pregnancy. Instead of 46 chromosomes, that pregnancy has 69, and those pregnancies don't survive, and so they're losses. And the textbook said, when you see a pregnancy loss and you see these trophoblast inclusions, which is the result of this abnormal folding that you mentioned, it's a triploid pregnancy. When you get that, you have to do a next step and prove that it actually is a triploid pregnancy. And less than half the cases that I saw trophoblast inclusions with actually were triploid. When I called the genetics lab and said, gee, what gives here? It's supposed to be triploid. It has trophoblast inclusions. What's going on? They said, oh, that case was a trisomy 18. That means an extra 18. Or a trisomy 13, an extra 13. Or that was a normal chromosome pregnancy, but there was a severe cardiac anomaly or a severe brain anomaly, and it terminated. So I started thinking to myself, you know, I think that this is a general marker, like the check engine light. It's not a specific finding, but just a general marker of something genetically wrong. And that was the preparation. That's the way I thought about this for many years, when by chance I happened to look at two cases that were sent to me from children with Asperger's syndrome, which is a form of autism, where the parents were suing the pediatrician and the vaccine makers, and they said, I think you caused our children's autism by these vaccines. When this case became a legal case, they sent me the placentas, the defense attorneys, and I saw trophoblast inclusion. So I said, well, you know, I have always seen this in the situations of genetic abnormalities. Maybe autism is a genetic abnormality. And that was about 10 to 15 years ago when the theory of vaccines was a big theory. And that's what everybody thought. And I said, you know, I don't think that's right. I think it's more accurate to say that this is genetic. So that's really what led by chance to this connection, and all the work we've done since then has been to prove that it's true.
So the study, Dr. Kleiman, you analyzed placentas from 217 births, and the families that had a risk for having autistic children, the placentas were more likely to have these folds and creases. What does that tell you going forward about identifying autism early?
That's a great question. So just to back up to make some context, after that observation of the two Asperger cases, I looked around, and I actually did this with my Yale colleagues back in 2006. We found children who definitely had autism, and we went backwards and tried to find all the placentas we could that were saved in the pathology labs to look at them, and we published a paper then and showed that there was a 3 to 4 times increased chance of those placentas from children with known autism to have these abnormal folds. Well, it was only 13 cases, and that's too small to really get too excited about. So I was very lucky when I read in the New York Times, actually, that the MIND Institute at University of California in Davis had been collecting placentas from at-risk families. What does that mean? An at-risk family is a family that already has one child with autism. And the reason that those families are so important to follow is those families have almost a 10 times fold increased chance of having another child with autism. And that just makes it convenient to study because, for example, if you were to have to take all the children and all the births out there, you'd have to do many more. It would be like doing breast cancer. You might want to look at the daughters of mothers that already have breast cancer. Those daughters are at increased risk, so any test that you might develop will show up in those daughters first. Just the same way, if you look at the at-risk families, they have an increased chance, so looking at markers in those families will just show up more easily. So the study that you refer to, the 217, was actually 117 placentas from the at-risk family compared to 100 controls, and we show that there was a tremendously increased frequency of these abnormal folds and trophoblast inclusions in the at-risk population compared to the normal population.
And so then you have this this initial knowledge. I even saw an article you were quoted as saying, well, you know, you could do some interventions if it proves to be true. How do you expect it to be used going forward?
Okay, and that's really the critical thing. There are a lot of tests in medicine where we do a test and say, yep, you're going to get Parkinson's disease sometime, we don't know when, and there's really nothing we can do about it. That's not really that useful. In fact, some people would say, you know, I don't even want to know. Why should I know beforehand? The reason this is so useful is that if you know at birth that this child is at risk, you can do really minor interventions, behavioral interventions, as maybe even as simple as calling the child, look at this, look at my face, follow this. I'll give you an example. One of the mothers who found out about her daughter being positive for this test did the test after the 2006 paper. Now, here's an example of what she found. She would call her daughter and make a noise behind her. Her daughter was looking away from the mother, and she didn't turn. Now, a lot of times, parents wouldn't really think about that as a problem because maybe the kid's absorbed into what they're doing. So she was wondering, okay, she's 6 months old. She's not responding to me calling. I'm going to take her in to get a hearing test. So she did, and the doctor said, nope, her hearing's perfectly fine. We did the test, and we know that the sound is getting to her brain. Well, the mother said, okay, but look at this. I'm going to stand behind my daughter and shout or make a noise or make something bang, and the daughter didn't turn, and they couldn't believe that, and they agreed with her. They said, okay, that's not normal. Once the mother recognized this as a problem, she actually started to train her daughter to turn towards a noise when you hear it. Now, she's much older, and she does this naturally. And that's an example of, because you know the check engine light was on, you might start to do interventions on behaviors that aren't obvious to you in the beginning that there might be a problem. And it's much easier to make these changes when children are very young, before 12 months of age, compared to 5 when they first go to school. By that time, the brain has laid down a lot of tracks, and it's much harder to change those behaviors.
And autism manifests later sometimes.
Yes. In fact, some parents, especially a first child, how would a parent know, you know, what is normal, not normal, really? And the CDC has reported that a typical time that a lot of families find out is when their child goes to school. The teacher, who has obviously a lot of experience with many kids, says, you know, Johnny is not quite behaving like the rest of the kids. I think we need to do some testing. And then they find out, well, now the child's 5, and we've missed, you know, 5 years of potential, you know, intervention and behavioral modification to change that child, and I think that's a shame. So I'm hoping that this discovery will help us be able to identify as many children as possible, as early as possible, so the interventions that the professionals who do this, I don't do the intervention, but the behavioral psychologists and psychiatrists and all the people who work in this field will be able to step up to the plate and say, we're going to develop techniques to really help these children at a very early age.
Dr. Kleiman, I appreciate you talking to us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Harvey Kleiman is a research scientist in obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences, director of Reproductive and Placental Research Unit at the Yale School of Medicine. Recent research by him has shown that babies born with a high genetic risk for autism also have abnormal folds and creases in their placentas, and they are looking at ways to understand that and connect that back to treatment. This is Weekday.
A strategy for improving your health by eating vegan just part of the day in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Soto Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor gardening supplies and hydroponics, featuring grow lights, General Organics, Sunshine Mix, and more. Baker Creek Seeds now available, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sotohydro.com.
46 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 57 today with partly sunny skies this afternoon. Tomorrow, sunny with a high of 65, and then lots of sun for the rest of the weekend, all the way through the weekend. So a good week for gardening, perhaps. We'll get some expert gardening tips in about 25 minutes.
It is a good week for gardening. A little rain, a little sun, a little thinking about what vegetables you're going to eat. 6 years ago, Mark Bittman's doctor told the overweight, pre-diabetic food writer that he had to adopt a vegan diet or go on medication. He didn't like the idea of lifelong medication. As a food writer, he lived and worked to eat, so neither alternative was appetizing. So instead, he made a deal with himself, he writes in his new book. He would follow a healthy diet throughout the day until dinner time, when he would eat in moderation whatever he wanted. He is healthier. He's lost weight. He doesn't take the medications. He called his plan Vegan Before Six. His new book based on that is called VB6. Bittman is a columnist for the New York Times, writing on food policy and cooking in the opinion section. His recipes, accompanied by some glorious food photography, can be found in most issues of the New York Times magazine. Mark Bittman is also author of How to Cook Everything. Look on your bookshelf. It's probably there. Put those books side by side and you would find a different approach to food.
Profoundly different, absolutely. In fact, there's a big difference. If you know, I'm the one watching this evolution most closely because it is mine. There's a big difference between the yellow and the red How to Cook Everything. That is the one that was published in 1998 and the one published in 2008. There's an equally big difference pending between How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, published in 2007, and the one, the 10th anniversary edition, which is going to be published in 2017. And it's really all about, in the How to Cook Everything books, it's really about less, or shall we say, fewer animal products. But in life in general, because How to Cook Everything doesn't really include processed foods, my cooking doesn't really include processed foods, the sort of mission is not only fewer animal products, but, you know, much less junk, much less of what passes for food in the marketplace but really isn't.
Do you think that, on the whole, a person who took the bad fake food out of their diet, how far along would they be towards eating healthier, just if they did that?
I have to qualify. I mean, they'd be way down the road. But the thing is that to take the junk out of your diet almost already implies that you're cooking. And if you took the junk out of your diet and you are cooking, you're way down the road. So in a way, to go back to your first question, if you looked at How to Cook Everything from 1998 and you cooked from that, you'd still be eating great. You just would probably be eating, you know, a sort of unbalanced diet in terms of animal products. You'd probably be eating too many animal products, unless, of course, you focused on the vegetable sections. But, you know, what I've been going through for the last 5 or 7 years and what's led to VB6 is really this idea that not only do you want to not eat junk, not only do you want to eat way more plant foods, really change the proportion of plants in your diet to everything else, but when you do eat meat, you want to tend to eat less of it. You want to try to eat less of it.
Mark Bittman's latest book is Eat Vegan Before Six, VB6, To Lose Weight and Restore Your Health for Good, the flexible diet you can really stick to with more than 60 easy, delicious recipes. You can really stick to this diet because you do offer me so many options, and you don't have a hammer above my head saying, oh, you violated the rules.
You know, I mean, when I describe VB6, which I can do in a sentence, it's basically eat no processed foods, no animal products during the course of the day, and then do whatever you want after 6 o'clock at night, which is to say, eat, drink, and be merry. When I describe that to people, they say, "Oh, I understand that, and I can do that." And the reason I think we can do it, and the reason I thought after 5 years or so of doing it myself that it was worth talking about more publicly, was that it's just delayed gratification. It's not eat weirdly for the next 2 weeks and you'll see great results, which doesn't work, as we know. And it's not be a vegan, which is what some people try, but is an extremely challenging way for people to eat, especially for those of us who were raised as omnivores. So, you know, this lets you, or encourages you, to be vegan for 2/3 of the day and omnivorous for the other third. And it's pretty elementary, and in a way it's pretty simplistic, but it works for a lot of people. It resonates for a lot of people.
I think I was looking at a recent New York Times magazine. It might not have been 2 weeks ago. It might have been earlier. It was red cabbage, different ways of cooking and preparing red cabbage. Do you remember that layout?
Yeah. It was actually cabbage, but the picture, you're right, was red cabbage. Oh,
that's right. It was, but that's right. It was all cabbages, and you were writing in that saying, there's a lot of things you can do with what you might have thought of as a simple flavor.
You know, a long time ago, I was partners with a guy, and this is a whole nother story, but I was partners with a guy, and we had an ideological split about food because one of us believed that there was a right way to do everything, and one of us believed that there were many, many ways to do everything, and I'm the second guy. And How to Cook Everything was the first big actually, Fish, my first book, was an expression of that, but How to Cook Everything was a kind of definitive expression of my belief that almost any ingredient can be treated in many of the same ways that you can treat other ingredients. So, you know, if for the word cabbage you substituted the word broccoli, you could probably make most of those recipes pretty much the same way. So this, it doesn't surprise me. You know, an old friend of mine says, there are only 9 recipes in the world. Everything else is a variation. And there's a woman named Elizabeth Rosin who wrote a book called The Flavor Principle 20 or 25 or 30 years ago that basically said there are a few techniques that we use to cook foods, and then all over the world we flavor them differently. And if you see things that way, you really understand what cooking is. And I completely buy that. There are a few cooking techniques. There are many, many different ways to flavor anything that you prepare using those techniques, and that stuff is widely exchangeable and widely applicable.
Mark Bittman's latest book is VB6, Eat Vegan Before 6. You have, at the beginning of the book, you have these charts comparing diet products and non-diet products, a diet bar versus a candy bar in terms of its calories, its fats, its carbohydrates, proteins. Same with a frozen diet lunch versus a vegan before 6 lunch. Why is it that we are inundated with promises from products? Well, I think we know why, because they can make a sale. But why are we willing to buy products that promise us something when all we need to do is look at the ingredients and know that they're not delivering what they're promising?
First of all, not everybody reads labels. Second of all, even those who do sort of tend to be in a hurry and often are not. This is not the priority, figuring this stuff out, for a lot of people. I think thirdly is that the illusion of choice is just that, and that you go into a supermarket and you see literally thousands and thousands of products, but if you go into the cereal aisle, it's hard to find a cereal that isn't junk food. So your choices are between one bad product and another bad product. They're not between a bad product and a good product, and all too often that's the case. So if you want an energy bar, a convenience bar, or whatever bar, that's just, say, pressed dried fruit with chopped nuts, and such bars exist, you have to look pretty hard for it, and they also tend to be expensive, and they may even be hidden in the so-called health food section of the supermarket. Everything that's down the aisle of granola bars is pretty much a candy bar in a different guise, and to single out one of the more egregious ones, and I mean, you can do what you will with this, but if you look at Clif bars, you're looking at a product with brilliant packaging, brilliant labeling, tastes really, really good, but you're looking essentially at a candy bar in a different guise, and that anyone can be tricked by that.
And it costs 3 times what a candy bar costs.
There is this whole thing about mock health food. Here we have something that looks healthy and sounds healthy, you know, and maybe has 20 grams of protein or is very low carbohydrate or something like that. But if you read the label and you look at what's going on, it's really a candy bar. So the marketing is very expensive. And, of course, everyone's looking for a bigger profit margin. So if you can sell a candy bar as a health food bar, yeah, you can make a lot more money.
You know, when you're comparing, for example, in this chart, Wheat Thins versus wheat berries, and the wheat berries are a half cup cooked wheat berries, hard red winter wheat, about 3.5 ounces. What would you do after you cook them? What would you do with these wheat berries?
Well, I think, you know, the first thing you do is get down on your hands and knees and thank your lucky stars that you just cooked something that has one ingredient in it, because that's kind of the way it's supposed to be. And you know, going back to what we were just discussing, all of this processed stuff, or a lot of this processed stuff that you look at, has 15, 20, 30, and sometimes more ingredients. And the unlabeled things, like a sandwich from a well-known fast food chain, may have 150 ingredients in it, 50 of which basically begin their lives as powder. So, or get put into food in the form of powder. So when you have these wheat berries, if you put salt and a little salt in cooking them and then finish them with some maple syrup or butter or soy sauce or honey or whatever else, now you're looking at something that has three ingredients in it, or two, depending on whether you count the salt, and it's pretty good. And it's super low calorie and super high fiber and really, really cheap and not bad at all. It just required perhaps a little more of your labor than the other thing would, but perhaps not, given that it's so much less expensive that you could afford, not that you'd want one, a lower salary and still be able to do it.
You know, you also have, for example, this is along the same lines, right on the facing page, store-bought chips versus homemade chips. You have a recipe for tortilla chips. Describe that recipe, but also describe why it's okay for me to eat tortilla crisps as you make them.
Well, in doing this book, but also in eating this way for the last 7 years, I am still an honest cook. I still play around, and I still make most of the food that I eat by myself. But one day, there is a very old Sicilian style pizza that's just tomato paste spread on top of dough, and I thought, well, what if I just take tomato paste and spread it on top of whole grain tortillas, corn tortillas, which are, again, a two-ingredient product made from whole grain. So I did that. I spread tomato paste on corn tortillas and baked them until they were crisp, and they're really great. The reason it's okay to make them is because the ingredients are essentially corn and tomatoes. You're not going to find a corn chip that's got that small number of ingredients, but even if you did, one of them would be oil because they're mostly fried.
Mark Bittman is author of VB6. He's a New York Times opinion writer writing about food and food policy. Can restaurants adopt these ideas and succeed?
I think in a way it's a easier track. It's very hard for fast food restaurants to change what they're doing. You know, I've spoken to board of directors, members of McDonald's, and they basically said, this is a steamship. It's going to take a long time to turn it around. I don't see any evidence of the rudder moving, but okay. We can cut them that much slack. But in a way, a new fast food chain, and I wrote about this a couple of weeks ago in the Times Magazine, a new fast food chain can come up with a relatively healthy, sort of good-for-you menu without a lot of trouble. That's doable. For casual dining and for fine dining restaurants, it's actually a little harder because they're trying to justify high prices, and people are still, for the most part, unwilling to see vegetable-based entrees as worth as much money as animal-based entrees. So that's a bit of a challenge. But nearly everyone who's launching a fast food chain now is trying to get into, you know, what they'd call the healthy segment or something like that, because so obviously where people are going and where they want to be going, and furthermore, where they want to be led, because everyone knows you can go into McDonald's intending to buy a salad and you're not going to buy a salad because it winds up being more expensive than an Angus burger. And what you really wanted when you walked into McDonald's in the first place was an Angus burger. But if there's no other option, that's what you're going to eat.
You know, we talked about this we've talked about the before six part. So after six, when you say go wild, party, But do you have limits?
Well, one limit is time. It doesn't mean that you can eat from 6 till midnight nonstop. The idea is that after 6, you have pretty much whatever meal you want, including dessert if that's your thing. But you still can't. Now is not the time to gorge. I mean, I'm not saying people should deprive themselves or not eat until they're full. But I do think that late night snacking is a problem for a lot of people. Double helpings of desserts is a problem for problems for a lot of people. So there are limits and there's some common sense involved here. But I would say that a big evening meal is what I'm after, and it is the payoff for let's say behaving yourself during the course of the day.
Is there a digestion issue? Is it okay to be eating heavy meats later in the day? How come you didn't do vegan after 6, for example?
Yeah, I'm vegan until 9 or something. It's a good question. I'm glad you asked it, and I hope the answer is good also. The science that's available to us is that we should be eating more fruits and vegetables, period. That's pretty much what the science has determined. Everything else is a strategy for doing that. And if I say to you, here's a diet that is perhaps, I'm not saying it is, but perhaps it's better if you have your biggest meal at 7 o'clock in the morning, and from then on, I want you to taper, and by 8 o'clock at night, I want you to be eating lettuce, versus eat the lettuce, you know, and the other stuff we've been talking about throughout the day, and at night, have a glass of wine, have a couple of beers, have a cheeseburger, have a steak, have lasagna, whatever. Most people in this country are going to opt for the second option, and I know, and I'm included in that group. We tend to socialize at night. We tend to have our biggest meal at night. We tend to want to have fun at night, and a diet or a lifestyle change or whatever you want to call this that ignores those things is really dumb. So, you know, at the end of the day, I want this to work and I want this to be pragmatic. Is it the ideal diet? Probably not. But it's a sort of perfect is the enemy of the good thing. I think it's a diet that people can do, and I think it's a diet that's really, really good. So, yeah.
Have you crunched the numbers at all in terms of what impact our diets, changing a diet like this might have on the larger fate of the planet and the food industries? The fate of the planet, because I know you touch on it. You know, a vegan diet would be better for the planet overall. But have you had a debate on that with some?
There are many numbers around about that, and the. I think my two favorite are, you know, if everybody in the United States ate 3 fewer cheeseburgers a week, it would be the equivalent of taking every SUV in the country off the road. So that's one fun one. And the other fun one is that a steak dinner for typical steak dinner for a family of 4 is like driving around all day long in an SUV while every single light in your house is on. So, you know, there are those kind of fun comparisons, but I think, you know, I think what we know is that it's much easier to grow vegetables, or let's say plants, than it is to produce animal products, and certainly it's easier than it is to produce junk food, which is actually quite challenging to produce. None of us could cook it at home. It takes less energy. It takes much less water. It's far less polluting. And so on. I mean, in the case of animal products, you're growing food that could feed people, and you're feeding it to animals, along with, you know, unconscionable or at least hard to imagine amounts of water. So those numbers have been crunched. They're all out there and easy enough to find. I'm very bad at memorizing stuff. I'm sorry. But
Cheeseburger analogy, the metaphor itself was...
That's the one I've memorized, yeah. Probably wrong, but I've memorized it.
Is still making you happy and healthy?
I don't have a problem with it anymore. It's so easy when I'm home, and this kind of goes back into the cooking thing. I mean, any time you want to control your diet, it's so much easier if you're preparing the food yourself. And that goes for me is the same as everybody else. So when I'm home this week, for example, I'm home all week, and it just, you know, I can make some breakfast, I can bring lunch or at least eat lunch in familiar places, I can have control of what's happening at dinner. It becomes pretty simple and straightforward. It's traveling and being out of the familiar places that make it really challenging. But again, it's, as I said before, if it's two steps forward, one step back, it's still an improvement in the way that you're eating and improving your diet, say, by 60%. An arbitrary number is obviously not as good as improving it by 90%, but it's considerably better than improving it by 40%. So you just have to think those things. You just have to say, well, today was not a particularly good day from a dietary perspective, but tomorrow will be better. And I do think we're able to function better when we're not seeing things in black and white. Oh, I'm a failure, therefore what the hell? Which is a very typical reaction to traditional diets.
Mark Bittman is author of VB6, Eat Vegan Before 6 to Lose Weight and Restore Your Health for Good. This is Weekday.
Oh, there goes a Buick 49, like the sheep of the angels riding down the line. We think there is a soul.
Want to get the honey, you don't go killing all the bees. Johnny Appleseed by Joe Strummer. Speaking of people who plant seeds, our gardening panel joins us here in a minute.
Hello, this is Dave Beck. KUW is grateful to everyone who participated in our recent spring membership drive. Now it's time to close our books. So if you've mailed in your pledge payment, thank you very much. If not, please send in your payment today. And thanks for supporting Public Radio, KUOW.
Yes, thanks a lot. We couldn't do it without you. 47 degrees in Seattle with clouds. Forecast says it'll be partly sunny this afternoon with a high of 57. Then mostly sunny tomorrow, getting up to 65 degrees.
Support for KUOW comes from Avalon Northwest Landscape, offering custom landscape design and construction to expand a home's living space into the outdoors. Committed to quality, client satisfaction, and environmental stewardship on every project. Portfolio online at avalonnw.com.
The Guantanamo Bay Detention Center needs to be closed. That's what President Obama said this morning, and he says he's going to re-engage with Congress to try to achieve that goal. More in 20 minutes.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground.
I was telling people that I got to choose some of the music today. I don't believe I chose that one.
Ah, come on, Steve. Own up to it.
That's very nice. We are gardening our way the top of the hour with Laura Matter, practicing horticulturist, Garden Hotline program coordinator at Seattle Tilth. Good to see you again.
Good morning.
Marty Wingate, who writes about gardens and traveling at martywingate.com, and her book Landscaping for Privacy is out, and her mystery, The Garden Plot, is headed for the shelves.
It is indeed.
And Greg Rayburn, who, as he said listening to this last segment, a lot of evening bacon consumption with that Mark Bittman diet, is the Vashon Basin steward and works on habitat restoration and salmon recovery on Vashon and Maury Islands. He's also co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. So you're a little nervous about the coming heat wave of next week for your garden?
Yeah. No, not for my garden, just for my being able to, you know, switch over from a high of 55 today to what? Potentially 80 degrees on Sunday.
Did you have sleet or mush on your lawn or on your...
I didn't notice it.
I heard it overnight. Yeah. Heard the thunder and...
It never rains on Vashon.
It is a beautiful place. It is a very beautiful place. All right, so what are you guys... what are you thinking about right now? People can write us with questions at weekday at KUOW.org, or you can email us, or you can call us at 206-543-5869 about your garden. What's that you brought in, Greg?
Well, it's Native Plant Appreciation Week. So, official.
So we walk around and appreciate native plants.
Yes, we do. And in honor of that and your upcoming absence, I brought you in a
beauty
camas as a gift for appreciating this venue to talk about native plants.
Look at this beautiful camas. It's already on its way to give us a little flower. Huh?
Yeah, and those were salvaged from a Pierce County prairie that was scheduled to be bulldozed. And it was a very rich in camas and other lilies on site. So it was
Why so many Pierce County prairies? Because it was at the tailing edge of the glacier all those tens of thousands of years ago? Or
it really has great conditions for the very gravelly soils that you find. And camas really likes to have winter and spring moisture, but then dry out. And that's what you get in those sorts of and dry out later in the summer. And that's what you really get in those gravelly soils.
Well, thank you. Now, will it be okay for me to put this right in the ground as long as I water it?
I would go ahead and, since it's just about to bloom now, I think I'd go ahead and wait till fall to put it in.
Just enjoy it in its pot. In this lovely black pot.
And from what I've read, they generally take 4 to 6 years to bloom. So that is, you have some.
Oh, that's an older camas then.
Yeah, it has, there's probably some decent sized bulbs in there.
And then it keeps cranking it out, right?
Yep. Yep, there.
Is this the kind of camas that people would harvest, or is this not the kind of camas people would harvest?
That's the kind they would harvest. They would
and enjoy.
Yeah, but there may be some bulbs in there that haven't flowered yet, which you don't want to eat those because they may be death camas, which sometimes grows.
You don't know what's mixed in there.
I will not do that.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah, and so I suspect when we were out salvaging on that prairie, we suspected that it may have been a very wealthy Native American sort of cultivated plot because it was so rich with very large bulbs.
How remarkable that you're out on these places that are being bulldozed to be turned into housing developments or whatever, mm-hmm. and we can sort of understand the history of the place by looking at the plant communities.
Yeah, they took a active hand in cultivating those areas.
Yeah. Very nice. Well, thank you. What are you thinking about? Top of camas. What are you thinking about?
Well, I do have camas in the parking strip, but they are not the native ones. And they are starting to bloom a sky blue color. They're just shockingly beautiful.
Very nice.
Pacific Coast Iris. One of mine is about to start blooming. And these are fabulous. A lot of them natural hybrids and some of them nursery hybrids of West Coast native iris. They'll cross-pollinate with any other Pacific Coast iris, so you never know what you're coming up with. And I bought one that has no cultivar name on it many years ago, and it's my favorite. It's gorgeous, yellow.
Fun.
Yeah.
All right. Laura, what are you thinking about or enjoying right now in your garden?
Well, speaking of camas, we actually do have camas in the Seattle Tilth Learning Garden at the Good Shepherd Center. And I just noticed it yesterday. It's in full bloom. It's gorgeous. So I welcome people to come over and check that garden out.
What happens there?
We teach classes out of that garden. We have a whole group of volunteers who help to maintain it, along with Sue Hartman, who is also a Garden Hotline educator, but she maintains that garden. And she works out there a couple days a week with folks. So if anybody's interested in volunteering, it's a great way to learn hands-on about how to do vegetable gardening. But we also have a lot of permanent plants. And there's a couple of rows of espaliered fruit trees, apple trees that are in full bloom. So they're really pretty right now. It's a great time to visit.
Yeah.
Plant sales this weekend. So if you come to the plant sale, you know, be sure to wander into the garden.
Yeah, I love wandering into that garden where everything's espaliered and everything. It's very nice. All right. What questions do you have for our panel about your gardens and the things you are growing? 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. You can email us weekday at KUOW.org. Andy's in Seward Park. Andy, you had a death in the garden, huh?
Yes. A 19-year-old japonica. It was doing fine early spring, seemed to overwinter fine, started to you know, get its little buds, and then all of a sudden it started to shrivel up. And I saw that just a tiny bit of it was still alive, and it just never bloomed. Hmm. Never, the buds never opened, and we're talking a big, big one. It was good-sized, you know.
Japonica.
A camellia.
A camellia.
No, a Japonica marginata.
Oh.
You know, the Lily of the Valley tree.
Oh, Pieris. Yeah.
Oh, yes, Lily.
Yeah, Lily of the Valley tree,
Andromeda is mm-hmm. another common name yes. for it. And so it's an old plant.
It's an old plant. We planted it when we moved into the house the first year, so that was like 1994.
Mm-hmm. And was the mature bark, does it kind of come off in strips?
It was, you know, now that I got in there and looked at it, because I actually, this weekend, I actually cut most of the dead stuff off. Mm-hmm. And there's one shoot that sort of came out from the side that's got living stuff on it. Huh. So I kept all that.
Yeah.
And cut the rest of it away.
Well, I don't know if you noticed, but probably the first thing to look at would be at the base of the plant to see if there had been anything chewing on the trunks. The one we have is a multi-stem one, so there are several trunks coming out from the ground.
Yeah, this is kind of, it's got a few trunks, and I had not seen anything chewing on it.
Yeah.
What would be chewing on it? What would chew on?
I do not know what would chew on the trunk of it. You never know. I don't know right off the bat of any. They're pretty tough shrubs, and I don't know of any disease that wipes them out completely. So if you see nothing cultural, nothing has changed in the garden around where that shrub is, the watering has not changed.
Yeah.
Then the next thing to do would be to take a sample of the tissue into the master gardeners.
Okay.
And to the, let one of the pathologists take a look at it. And if you can take it to, the Center for Urban Horticulture, they have a master gardener there on Monday evenings from 4 to 8, or you could look, for the master gardener clinic nearest you if you don't
right.
want to
yeah,
go to that one.
They're terrific. And, you know, there is a, you know, small section that's alive and we'll see how I mean and it did kind of shoot off, you know, it's not from there's a it's almost like it came out from the bottom,
so it's coming from the roots and not
from the root area.
Yeah.
And has so I mean can they just die of old age?
I can't imagine them die. The one in our garden has got to be at least 40 years old, if not older.
Yeah, it's unusual for something to die that quickly of old age.
Yeah.
So something dramatic may have happened that you aren't quite aware of. Mm. And I'm with Marty, you know, cultural things can actually do that kind of quick damage, things that you wouldn't think about, you know, if you painted the house, if you put more mulch down perhaps than you thought you did, some kind of contamination could have happened. Mm. Is there any damage to anything else in the area?
I mean, there's a huge native huckleberry that's a couple of feet away from it.
And it's fine?
That's doing beautifully.
Wow. Yeah, same family.
It's got some irises near it. There's mountain bluets. There's a juga.
It's all sorts of stuff.
Nothing will kill a juga.
Yeah. So that's the same family?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't
yeah,
know that.
Pieris is in the heath family, just like rhododendrons, azaleas, blueberries.
All right, master gardeners for you. I'm putting in an in-ground herb garden. What kind of soil additions would be ideal? I've read that some prefer dry soil. I have chives, sage, parsley, cilantro, thyme, rosemary. Will they all get along in one bed? They'll all get along in one bed, won't they? Chives, sage, parsley, cilantro, well, thyme, rosemary.
Yes, sort of.
put the cilantro, parsley, and chives in one side?
I would, yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
The Mediterranean herbs that are woody, like the rosemary or lavender, or oregano, marjoram, thyme, those things, don't like really rich soils, and they like things to drain well, so sort of rocky, gravelly soils they appreciate. So if you have that type of soil, don't worry about amending it. But the others are more herbaceous and would appreciate kind of more organic soils. And so, you know, you can have them near each other, but maybe segregate them a little bit and change the soil to suit.
I neglected to cut back my hydrangeas last fall. Peggy writes, can I cut them back now and how far? I think we got this last week, too. She can cut them back, right?
Well, yes.
Not really?
Well, no. I mean, you can cut them back any time.
Yeah. But she just won't get any flowers.
She may be cutting some of the flowers off if she cuts them this late. If there are, if the ends of stems are dead, cut back the dead part to the big fat buds that are, well, mine are already leafed out. And if the whole thing is too big, cut out one or two of the tallest branches and leave it for this year, I think.
All right. I just put up hoop houses with clear plastic over my raised beds to keep critters out, increase the temperature. Should I uncover the beds when the plants get to a certain size or just keep growing them? Broccoli, kale, cauliflower, tomatoes.
Well, uncover them on Sunday.
Yeah.
You want to open ends up, especially when it gets warm. Even if you get a 70-degree day, you want to get some ventilation in there. I have actually grown tomato, basil, and peppers through the summer with a hoop house continually, taking things off, taking the plastic off in June and replacing that with Remay or the floating row cover, which actually lets more air in.
Oh, I see.
And that warms the airspace. But the most important thing is that ventilation. So if you choose to keep it on to keep the heat up, you need to make sure you're not cooking them through the summer.
Especially those coal crops, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those guys, actually, I would take plastic off of those. Yeah.
I would like to plant a vine-covered teepee this summer, big enough for my one-year-old daughter to play in, my dogs as well. I thought about combining some vining plants such as peas, beans, nasturtiums. Last year, peas did not do so well. Any recommendations? Have you done
Scarlet runner beans.
Runner
beans. That'd be great.
But then you have all those irritating hummingbirds coming around.
Yeah. That would be terrible.
Yeah.
We have a houses going up behind us. We'd like to plant a privacy screen that will be bird friendly, especially in the summer. Again, right? More scarlet running beans.
Yep. Well, you could also, if you want to do a vegetable screen, you could do that, but it'd only be seasonal.
Yeah.
So if you want to mix in a variety of different trees or shrubs that get to a certain size, then one of my favorites is Oregon grape. And that one you can make jams and jellies or jellies from the berries and mix that in with some plants that lose their leaves that grow quicker.
Well, they don't want anything higher than 10 to 12 feet tall.
Hazelnut.
So, yeah.
Our native hazelnut. You can maintain. I would vote for California wax myrtle. It might get a little taller than that, but it can take cutting back well, and it's a near native, and
it's a near native,
and the birds love it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The birds love it.
All right, Greg posted on our Green Days KOW Green Days page all about Native Plant Appreciation Week, so people can go there and find out more about all the native plants and how they're being celebrated.
Yeah, all kinds of different events and upcoming native plant sales and lots going on.
And people can ask you questions at the Garden Hotline, right?
They indeed can.
What number should they call for that?
206-633-0224.
And what should people ask you questions about next time they see you?
Anything they want.
All right. Are you going to be anywhere?
A week from Saturday, I'm going to be at the Bellevue Demonstration Garden, Master Gardener Demo Garden.
All right, good. You guys will be here. I won't. As I said, I'll be off for 5 months. I have to think about the future of radio. So I thought I'd take 5 months. After 26 years of doing daily radio, I'm going to take 5 months off to not have a daily deadline and think about what the future of radio is.
And
write. But I don't, you don't talk about that too much, Marty, because, you might not, pull it off.
I keep bugging you, Steve.
Might not pull it off, but I'm going to try. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Magano, Amin El-Sadi. Marcy Silman will be your host. They'll all be here giving you great radio. I hope you will continue to enjoy it. And Bernard Ouellette will continue to be here being our engineer and your host for much of the morning and the afternoon. And you guys I'll be gardening with you all summer.
Excellent.
You guys, it's been a pleasure talking to you guys all through these years, and I look forward to talking to you again October 1st.
We'll see you in 5 months, Steve.
Take care.
Elvis Costello on KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. 10:59. Home prices are in the news this morning. We'll find out why in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Everett Clinic, offering a wide range of minimally invasive, high-tech surgical techniques, including laparoscopy, surgical robotics, and image-guided surgery. More at everettclinic.com/tech.
What is information and what is noise? The life or death question in evaluating intelligence.
We're always going to be that hockey goalie that unfortunately lets one puck go by every once in a while.
Frontline looks at whether the name Tamerlan Tsarnaev slipped through the net for U.S. intelligence agencies. Correspondent Dana Priest joins us next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.